Christmas is a time of traditions, and our family growing up was no different than any other in that there were certain things that happened at Christmas time that were borderline mandated. It didn't feel like Christmas if we didn't do them, and one of those that I really enjoyed as a kid was that Christmas Eve, our tradition was after everything had been done, after we had gone to the service, and we'd opened our one present on Christmas Eve, and then the rest on Christmas morning, that was part of the tradition, and we'd had our food, that the last thing that we did is we would sit down as a family and we would watch George C. Scott's rendition of Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol, which is the only one worth watching other than The Muppets' Christmas Carol. Just so that that's out there, I want to be clear. The main character in George C. Scott's Christmas Carol is Ebenezer Scrooge, easily one of the most unpleasant characters in literature. He is unable to enjoy anything. And he's angry at anyone who does enjoy anything. When presented with the opportunity to be generous and charitable at Christmas time, he says, "I do not make merry myself. I do not see why I should make idle people merry." He's easily the most dislikable person you'll ever encounter. And Charles Dickens' little story about these three spirits that intrude into his space on Christmas Eve result in his transformation into one of the most generous and charitable people you'll ever meet. There's something about that story that is very true to the spirit of Christmas. We find ourselves, if we are honest, in the position of Scrooge. And Christmas offers us the opportunity to have our space intruded upon, to have our world and our lives invaded by a person that can transform us into something entirely different. And that is what our story is this morning. We're going to encounter three kings, if you will. Not the three kings you might expect, although we will encounter the group known as the Magi. And as you've probably been made aware, they were neither kings, nor do we know that there were three of them. But singing "We Indeterminate Number of Kings from Orient Are" just doesn't have quite that ring to it. So we'll roll with that. But there were the Magi, but there was also Joseph. Joseph, as we read 2 weeks ago, that was the descendant of David, a legitimate heir to the throne of Israel, a true king, and yet without a throne, a crown, or a rule. And thirdly, we will encounter King Herod, an equally unpleasant figure, unfortunately, just as unpleasant, if not more so, than Ebenezer Scrooge, and yet not an invention of fiction, but a real flesh and blood human being whose story ends not happily, but tragically, and we'll deal with him as well today. So if you'll turn with me to Matthew chapter 2, each of these three kings is going to have their space intruded upon. Their lives are going to be invaded by the same person, the same reality, the same encounter. And we're going to consider their reactions. Matthew 2, beginning in verse 1. "Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem saying, 'Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star where it rose and have come to worship him.' When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, 'In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet, 'And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel.' Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, 'Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him.' After listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother. And they fell down and worshipped him. Then, opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. In this encounter that we see, we first are made aware of these magi from the east. And there's a lot of discussion about who exactly they were, where exactly the east is that they came from. The most likely scenario is that they are from Persia, from Babylon, the land to which the Jews had been exiled at the fall of the southern kingdom of Judah and the destruction of the temple, the places where Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego and Ezekiel had found themselves living. In other words, a place where there would have been an awareness of the Jewish people, their scriptures, their beliefs. And these magi, it's a term for sort of court counselors who relied on divination and magic. It is related to our word magic. These were people who were thought to have an access to supernatural powers, both to discern what was going on in the world and also to affect its outcome. And so kings relied on them. And so in that sense, they are royal figures. They probably represent a royal court from far away. And their methods, of course, would be anathema to the Jewish people, who were told to stay away from witchcraft and divination and all of these sorts of means of discerning things. And these magi come and they say, "We've seen a star that rose that tells us that someone's been born king of the Jews, and we've come to worship him." And so they show up in Jerusalem, the capital, which is where they would expect a king of the Jewish people. And what's interesting in this story is the text does not say that they went to Herod. Herod heard about their inquiry. And what you need to know about Herod is he can't be the king of the Jews because he's not a Jew. He's an Idumean. He's a foreigner. His throne is only made possible by the Romans, who are currently the overlords of the land of Judea. And they've installed Herod as a puppet king, a client king that is dependent on the Romans for his rule. His rule is not legitimate, and everybody knew it, including, it seems, the Magi. And so they come and they say, "Where is the one who has been born king of the Jews?" The phrase is important. Not born to become king of the Jews. When a son is born to a king, he's not king yet. He has to wait until the sitting king has died. And that's why we believe that they didn't go to Herod, because they believe someone who's been born who is actually at present, at the moment of his birth, the king. And so he obviously has no biological connection to Herod. Well, Herod hears about their inquiry and summons them. And the word for ascertain from them has to do with kind of an under the bright lights interrogation. He wants to find out exactly when and where this king was born. And so he asks his royal courtiers, "Where would this anointed ruler, this Messiah, this Christ be born?" And they answer confidently, "Bethlehem." Everyone knows that. Micah 5:2 says so. And so he sends them to Bethlehem, interestingly not going with them. And it's at this point that the Magi, who probably do not know Herod even by reputation, begin to pick up that there's something in the water here with Herod. And so they go and they find the child and they worship and they give their gifts. And then they are warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, but to go to their country by another way, no doubt a long roundabout way to avoid detection by Herod. They know that this is dangerous, that Herod's intentions are not sincere and pure. It's interesting, as I read the commentaries about these magi, everyone seems very concerned not to say more than is appropriate about them, particularly that they worshiped the child. There's a concern, it seems, not to ascribe to that actual worship. In other words, not to assume that the magi knew what they were doing. And so they try to soften that word worship to say, well, it can also be used of like the honor that you would give to a king. In other words, let's not make the mistake of thinking the Magi knew what was what in Bethlehem that night. And I think that's dangerous for a variety of reasons. One of which is the whole point of these 12 verses is to point out that the wrong people are worshiping Jesus. The right people fail to recognize and respond appropriately. And we'll delve into their responses a little later on. But the whole point here is that the very people who should have known exactly where the Messiah was to be born and should have responded appropriately with worship to the news that the King of the Jews had been born respond incorrectly. And it's the people you'd least expect, the people who follow a false religion and practice false worship, that travel great distances at great personal expense and worship this child. The wrong people show up at the house. And yet not so, because this is what our God delights to do, and this was prophesied. Isaiah 60 told us that nations, Gentiles, non-Jews shall come to your light. And what is the light of Israel but the presence of God, the Word made flesh, as John tells us, who in him was light, and that light was the life of men. Gentiles will come, and kings to the brightness of your rising. We have seen his star as it rose. They shall bring gold and frankincense, and shall bring good news, the praises of Yahweh. I used to be one of those people who wanted to be very hesitant to say, pagan astrologers can't possibly be right about the Messiah. And yet Isaiah says it's exactly those kinds of people who will praise Yahweh. I think the Magi knew exactly what they were doing. And here's one of the things that I became aware of this week. As many of you know, I am a bit fanatical about bringing believers and followers of Jesus together across all of the sorts of things that have historically divided us. And I didn't expect to find encouragement to pursue that in the Christmas story. But here it is, and here's the principle. When you are kneeling and have fallen down on your face and emptied your hands of everything valuable to you before the Son of God, you really don't care who it is that's next to you doing the same. When we are worshiping Jesus, we will not ask the question, is anyone here worshiping him who ought not to be? And yet how often is that their part? Are they really a true church? Are they really preaching the true God? Could we really? That's not theoretical. I hear those questions and those concerns constantly. And I fear that the reason we ask those questions is because our faces are not down in the dirt with our hands outstretched and empty before the sun. Let us be wise people this Advent season. The story continues. Because the story is not about the Magi, incidentally. And so when the Magi had departed, verse 13, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him. And he rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, out of Egypt I called my son. The Magi are gone, and just because they're not going to report back to Herod about this baby does not mean the danger has passed. And so this angel of the Lord, who is putting some miles on his frequent flyer card, this story, shows up 5 times in the first 2 chapters of Matthew in dreams and tells Joseph, you need to leave the country. You need to go to Egypt. And Joseph does, and we're going to talk in some detail about Joseph in a little bit. But one of Matthew's concerns in telling the story of Jesus in this chapter is, first of all, to indicate that the right people missed him and the wrong people saw him. But it is also to say that Jesus has embodied Israel's experience as God's chosen people. That what happened to Israel also happened to Jesus, their anointed Messiah. that Jesus is reliving their experiences. And so Matthew quotes Hosea 11:1, which has nothing to do with the Messiah in its original context. It is not a predictive prophecy. It's a recounting of God's dealings with Israel. And it says, "When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son." It speaks to the love that God had for his people that caused him to call them out of bondage, out of the land of slavery, and bring them into the promised land, into relationship with him, and that it was his love for them that did that. His love that had prompted him to make promises to Abraham, when Abraham had done nothing to put himself in God's debt. And so, all through the story of the Old Testament, we see God acting out of love to rescue his people. And so just in the same way that Israel was called out of Egypt, redeemed from bondage, Jesus did as well. He fled to Egypt and he will be summoned back from Egypt. And so as we talked about last week, that Jesus is a sojourner. He carries our experiences, our burdens. This Jesus is going through the experience of being cast out into a foreign land amidst hostility, and that he will be summoned back to the promised land. And so the story continues now. Egypt is safe for a while, and it's good that they went there, because in verse 16, Herod, when he saw that he had been tricked by the wise man, became furious, and he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old and under, according to the time that he had ascertained from the wise men. The word "tricked" there is the same word that is used of the soldiers who mocked Jesus. Herod receives the fact that the Magi had failed to come back and report to him, that they are mocking him. And when we think about the way that our Savior was mocked, he was mocked by people who thought that he was pretending to be a king. And they drew attention to that. I think Herod feels similarly. He knows that he is a pretender to the throne, and the Magi's actions have served to mock his pretense. Our Savior was mocked wrongly. Herod knows he's been mocked, and it's correct because he is a pretender to the throne. And so he kills all of the baby boys in Bethlehem and the surrounding area. One thing we know about Herod from this story is he is deliberate and thorough in his actions. He is not a raving madman, which is not to say that he is not deeply unsettled, but he is not a raving madman. His actions are calculated and deliberate. He carefully prescribes the region in which to carry this out. It's perfectly consistent with his personality, even though this is the only record of this act. No other historian records it, probably because it only amounted to the deaths of 20 or so children, and unfortunately in the ancient world, that just wasn't newsworthy. But it's perfectly consistent with Herod's character, he who killed three of his own children as well as one of his 15 wives. Yeah, it's a messed up family. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping in loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted because they are no more. Again, Matthew quotes an Old Testament prophecy, an Old Testament prophetic passage, and again, one that is looking back to the exile, when Rachel, who was seen as the mother of Israel, weeps for her children because they've been slaughtered by the Babylonians and carried into exile. Ramah was on the path that the exiles would have followed as they left Jerusalem and went into Babylon to captivity. Again, Jesus is reliving the tragedies of Israel's past. He knows what it is to be cast out in a foreign country, to be in exile, to have suffered slaughter that he was spared from. But when Herod died, verse 19, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, rise, take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who sought the child's life are dead. And he rose and took the child and his mother and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea in place of his father Herod, the apple does not fall far from the tree, he was afraid to go there, and rightly so. And being warned in a dream, He withdrew to the district of Galilee, and he went and lived in a city called Nazareth, so that what was spoken by the prophets might be fulfilled, that he would be called a Nazarene. And so we encounter Jesus of Nazareth in these passages. The first 12 verses show us that the wrong people show up at the house to worship, and the right people are nowhere to be seen. Right and wrong, of course, by human categories. Here we see that the Messiah himself is rejected, is consigned to a place among the wrong people. He himself is cast out, away from the centers of power. He grows up in a place called Nazareth, a place virtually unknown in the ancient world. So much so that in John's gospel, when someone is told that Jesus of Nazareth is the promised one, their response is, Nazareth? Can anything good come from Nazareth? That nowhere place? That podunk one-horse town? Or one-donkey town, as the case may be. And it's Nazareth of Galilee. Galilee that's been polluted by Gentiles who have moved in and intermarried and tainted the ethnic purity of the Jewish people. I mean, if it was in Judea, even if it was a small town, that would be one thing. But Nazareth in Galilee? No. No one with the surname of Nazareth could possibly be the Messiah, and yet it's one of the most common designations in the Gospels and in Acts for Jesus. So often he is introduced as Jesus of Nazareth, as though the authors wanted to remind us and put it right out there. Yeah, God did that. He sent the promised one from nowhere, from where you'd least expect it. And so we could say that Jesus is a foreign king. We've talked about that he is a sojourner, a royal, and an exile. And here I want to explain a distinction between a sojourner and an exile. A sojourner is someone who travels to a new country to take up residence by choice. We might call them an immigrant. They've made a conscious decision to move to somewhere. An exile is someone who takes up residence in a foreign place by force. We might call them a refugee. Jesus knows what it is to be both of those things. He has left his home above and voluntarily decided to take up residence here. But John soberly tells us that he came to people who ought to have regarded him as their own, and his own did not receive him. They rejected him, and so he became an exile, first in Egypt and then in Galilee. He knows what it is to be an immigrant and a refugee. So now what? What are we to do with this Jesus? Well, as I suggested, there are three kings in this story who each respond in their own way to Jesus. And that gives guidance for us in how we respond. And so the first is King Herod, the only one with that title specifically given to him. Herod, as I said, is a usurper. He's a pretender to the throne. He has no business being the king of Israel, either legally or by virtue of moral character. One seminary professor that I heard from said he was a vile toad that sat on the throne of Israel. That may be harsh, but it's probably accurate. He was vicious, paranoid, and we see it mirrored in this story. We read, when he hears that one has been born king of the Jews, that the rightful king has been born, he was troubled, deeply upset within his soul, because he knew that his kingdom that was false was being threatened. And so he takes very careful and deliberate steps to protect himself from that threat by eliminating it. And when he finds out that his first attempt to have the Magi tell him, where is he so I can find him, and specifically a targeted hit, only kill the threat. When he finds out that that has been thwarted, that others have thrown in their lot with this baby, he is furious. And in his rage, he takes further calculated and deliberate actions. And he is not alone, unless we think that we are too far removed from Herod. John 11:48, remember those priests and the scribes of the people who gathered together? And he asked them, where is this child going to be born? And they know it's not an academic question. This isn't Herod doing late night theology and saying, hey, I was wondering, you know, in the way that I reach out to Glenn Kerr and say, Glenn, I was wondering about something. This is what they said after Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. If we let him, Jesus, go on like this, everyone will believe in him. Hear that. If we let Jesus do what he's doing, everyone's going to believe in him. And the result is that the Romans will come and take away our place and our nation. They will remove the temple and they will remove our power. Here's the scandalous thing that we might miss in reading that interaction between Herod and the chief priests. The chief priests are members of the Sanhedrin. They're Sadducees. The Sadducees don't believe that Micah 5:2 is part of the Bible. They only read the first five books. So they answer this question saying, yeah, if there was a Messiah, he'd be born in Bethlehem, but there's not. So it is merely academic, Herod. They don't believe that this is really real. They have closed themselves off to the truth of God's word, and they have set themselves up in positions of power of their own making, and they guard it jealously. I wonder if in John 11, they're worrying, saying, boy, 30 years ago, if we had helped Herod, maybe we could have killed this guy before he got started. Did we miss our chance? Their apathy in Matthew 2 becomes Herod's action again, played out at the crucifixion. And what is it? It is fear. There is a lot for us to be afraid of these days. And one of the things that is interesting to me is that as we talk about these things that cause us to be afraid, we get really angry. We get furious. And we quickly identify those who are the enemy. And we speak and conduct ourselves in ways that communicate that we wish they were just gone. Think about the family you will gather with over the next couple of weeks. I won't ask for a show of hands, but I venture that if I did, most of us would raise our hands and say, we're nervous that the subject of politics just might come up around the Christmas table. And that will not be a pleasant or thoughtful or gracious conversation. That it will be laced with anger among people who love each other. And I would submit that while there are things that we are right to be afraid of, fearful over, and possibly things that we are right to feel anger over, that we allow anger to be the driving force because we've allowed fear to take root in our hearts. Joseph was afraid of Archelaus. Nothing wrong with that. But when fear becomes the driving force, we have abandoned biblical faith. Fear and faith cannot both be the underlying reality of our hearts. And that's why I love Joseph. Joseph, who is in many ways a focal point for Matthew, where Mary is the focal point for Luke. In fact, I love that the only place he doesn't show up in this story is when the wise men show up. It just says they see the mother and the child. Joseph's totally in the background. And in his supporting role, he takes center stage in this story because five times an angel shows up to him and says, Joseph, do this and this. And the text it's almost as though Matthew just cut and pasted what the angel says and replaced it with, and Joseph did. Joseph did exactly what he was told, to protect the child and his mother. That's Joseph's job. It meant scary circumstances. It meant uncertain realities. It meant a degree of courage and faith. And Joseph operates primarily out of faith, not out of fear, and protects the mother of the Messiah and the child. We need to operate more out of faith than out of fear. And the result is that we will become the Magi. The most important verse in this chapter is verse 10. When they saw the star over the place where the child was. They rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. English just doesn't have the necessary tools to communicate what Matthew is saying in the Greek. They joyed joyfully with joyful joy abundantly. It's like he can't express the joy that rose up in their hearts as they're living under the threat of this tyrannical madman who they must have figured out by now does not have good intentions towards this child. And their exceedingly great, abundant, joyful joy causes them to fall down on their faces and empty their treasure chests of everything that they brought and put it at the feet of this peasant family in this little hovel in this backwater nowhere of a rural province that means nothing, and then leave, taking a long way home because an angel told them to. It's the joy that I want to focus on. Many of us feel that the anger and the fear that we feel over many of the conversations happening in our culture are driven by biblical truth. We believe that God has said something about the way that culture and society and government and economies are supposed to be run, and when that is threatened, we get scared and we get angry. And so often what I see is that we stay there. And I just want to say this about that. If that's where you stay, you may be right, but you are following Herod's model. Biblical faith, adherence to the person of Jesus, leads to joy. And joy is a choice. Joy is a choice that does not depend on circumstances and doesn't deny circumstances. Joy is a choice of obedience. When it doesn't make sense and you're not the right person, you show up at the house anyway, and you fall down, and you are exuberantly joyful, and it leads you to let go of everything valuable, because you're not ultimately scared, because a king has been born. So I want to ask us, it is really easy to give in to the despair and the darkness of what we see around us. Christmas invites us to embrace joy. Will you embrace joy as wise people this season? Let's continue in worship.